State versus Shire.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jared Steed appearing on behalf of the appellant Yusuf Shire. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. Your Honors, double jeopardy prohibited Mr. Shire's retrial after the trial court sua sponte declared a mistrial.
I think it would be useful to focus on the material witness warrant issue.
I agree, Your Honor.
But separate from that, if you have something to add or say differently, I don't want to preclude you from addressing
certainly
double jeopardy in the mistrial.
And I appreciate that. We can revisit that at a later time.
If there's something you want to say that's
sure
different or helpful or...
And I will give that some thought. But my next point was, I think I would agree with Your Honor that as far as this case goes, focusing on the material witness warrant would be appropriate. So moving to that, there's no dispute here that Burkett was both subject to a material witness warrant and that his anticipated testimony was material. He was the only witness who would have testified that my client was not the shooter. And that's an important distinction. We do have Mr. Barnes saying, I don't know who the shooter is, but we have Burkett willing to say that it was not my client. And that's an important distinction here because that's exculpatory evidence. And both the trial court and the state below realized the importance of that anticipated testimony. So with that in mind, the issue here really surrounds the timeliness of the request for a warrant. And, you know, in this particular instance, Shire did not request a recess. But even if he had requested a recess,
is that part of the ineffective assistance?
That's certainly one aspect of it, yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I know it's framed as he didn't make a timely request for the material witness warrant. I think that's the thrust of the argument.
That is certainly a point, but I would agree with Your Honor that part of this, the timely request and the failure to request a continuance along with that.
Because he didn't.
He did not request a continuance, no.
So, all right, so now we're going to focus on the timeliness.
So focusing on the timeliness, the record here doesn't show that even if a request had been made that it would have unnecessarily delayed trial. And this is significant for the analysis from the court's perspective about Wright denying it, notwithstanding the ineffectiveness of the late request in this point. But significantly here, the trial court did not find and the state did not argue that granting of a material witness warrant would have unnecessarily delayed trial. Rather, it denied it because it was untimely made, which goes exactly to the point that we've raised regarding the ineffective assistance of counsel. But I think it's important in this case to realize that, you know, in the Edwards case, the Supreme Court found a nearly analogous denial of a continuance to secure the presence of three witnesses who were only subpoenaed the day before the request was made, or the night before, rather, to be a violation of his constitutional right to a compulsory process. And
now you also argue denial of the right to present a defense. How does that relate to the constitutional claim?
Sure.
Compulsory
process. I think they go hand in hand here, right? By denying this material witness warrant, the trial court effectively denied Shire the opportunity to present witnesses in his defense that would have been favorable to him. Specifically, again, somebody here who was prepared to testify that my client was not the shooter, which was very much the only issue at trial here is the identity of the shooters. Who are the shooters?
Well, since the right to present a defense is not absolute, are there constraints related to the discretion that we give the court to consider the factors that the court is supposed to consider?
Well, the right to present a defense, and the case law is clear that the right to present a defense and the denial of a compulsory process go hand in hand under these particular situations.
And is there a particular case you're...
Your Honor, if I could address that on rebuttal, I would be happy to grab my brief.
Okay.
And
sure.
I will make a note of that. But just to move on shortly to the ineffective assistance of counsel part with respect to the late request, The record here shows that the trial court would have granted the request for a material witness warrant, as it noted, had that request been made a week earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem here, because we have several opportunities here for defense counsel to request that material witness warrant before he actually did so. We have a witness who, by all accounts, has been difficult to get in touch with, yet the state has subpoenaed him at the beginning of the second trial. Nothing precluded defense counsel from also subpoenaing him and setting it up essentially for a material witness warrant if neither one of those subpoenas were honored. He could have also requested a material witness warrant immediately after the fact that the state disclosed that it didn't intend to call Burkett, which was on September 11th, I believe. And here we don't have the request for a material witness warrant being made until September 16th. Actually, September 17th, Your Honor. So a full week, or almost a full week, goes by between the time that defense or the state says, we're not going to call this witness, and defense counsel actually requesting this material witness warrant. And, you know, nothing in the court rule precludes defense counsel from requesting a material witness warrant based on the state's subpoena. As soon as the state says that, defense counsel could say, well, Your Honor, clearly doesn't intend to honor that subpoena. I want a material witness warrant. In any event, the third aspect here that I think is important is that defense counsel could have subpoenaed him, assuming that he wasn't subpoenaed right at the start of trial, assuming that the material witness warrant wasn't requested as soon as the state indicated that it didn't intend to call Burkett because they didn't think he was going to honor that subpoena. He could have still requested a subpoena himself sometime before he actually did, which occurred, he makes a record that the subpoena was served on Burkett on the night of the 16th, or at least Burkett confirms that he received the subpoena on the night of the 16th, and that material witness warrant isn't requested until the 17th. Just real quickly, I want to point out that there was no strategy to this, to move to the second prong of the Strickland test. This is clearly a witness who was helpful to my client. He's prepared to testify that this is exculpatory, that my client was not the shooter. Defense counsel recognized the importance of that testimony because he's repeatedly saying on the record, I want to call this Burkett as a witness. And, you know, to suggest that these facts would have been cumulative misconstrues the record in the sense that he's the only witness who's in a position to testify that my client is affirmatively not the shooter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Morning again.
Morning.
James Wiston, appearing on behalf of the State of Washington on Mr. Shire's case also. Your Honor, I'm going to start with the ineffective assistance argument and then may have a couple comments for the material witness argument, the timing of the motion after that. First, let me just say that the Court's, I'm sure, very familiar with the standard for ineffective assistance of counsel. It's the defendant's burden of showing both deficient performance and prejudice. But there's an important aspect of the Strickland case that I think that comes into play here, and that is the U.S. Supreme Court warned against the distorting effects of hindsight. And I think this is a classic example of that, because looking at it from an appellate lawyer's perspective, you can probably ask, well, why wouldn't you go out and get a material witness warrant for this person?
And that relates to the deficient performance prong.
Yes. But what I want to encourage the Court to do is put yourself in the shoes of Mr. Shire's defense lawyer. Remember, this is a witness who was wholly impeachable. And if you look at Mr. Jurczyk's comments at the December 17th hearing, he outlines the risks that he thinks exists for calling this witness and essentially says to Judge Ramsdale at the time, I'm offering this witness because my client wants me to. I've given him that choice and he wants me to. So Mr. Jurczyk is now facing a witness who he recognizes is wholly impeachable, and I can list all the ways if I need to, but he's very impeachable.
So that's previously.
That's previously, correct.
So now we're in front of Judge Downing, and
exactly.
Judge Downing doesn't know what he previously said.
Yeah, and the problems with this witness include the fact that he'd been communicating with the defendant over the phone by jail, the fact that he came to the trial, the fact that he waited 6 or 7 months before stepping forward and saying, oh, these two guys aren't the shooters at all. They were friends. Why would you wait to do that, et cetera? There were so many liabilities that he had that I think what the record reflects is that Mr. Jurczyk had misgivings about this witness. Then the witness is absent for the 9 months between the first and the second trial. No contact with anybody. And Mr. Jurek knows that there's this letter that is in evidence that indicates that Shire is interested in paying witnesses to leave town, $1,000 a month, to get out of the country, to get out of the state, to avoid them having testimony.
Is that part of our record?
Yes, it is. It's an exhibit in the case, Your Honor, and I'm sorry I don't have the record site right now where it was discussed. So this witness is going to be very problematic. But the most important thing, I think, is this witness existed basically at the witness's own grace. In other words, Mr. Shire was not going to endear himself to this witness by having the witness arrested and brought into jail and sit in jail for a few days. His testimony was going to be problematic at best, and I think it was a wise move on part of Mr. Jurek to let it play out and see if the witness was going to present himself on his own.
Which he said he would.
Which he said he would.
In Judge Downing's trial.
Exactly.
In theory, towards the end.
He apparently said he did. And remember, this is ineffective assistance of counsel claim that's brought with no record as to what counsel was thinking or what he was learning from his clients. He may have been assured by his own client that this witness was going to show up, et cetera. Now, maybe there were promises of payment that didn't come through, whatever it is. Mr. Khabibi had his own issues with a warrant that was outstanding from municipal court. There are a lot of reasons why he may not have shown up. But I think it was a perfectly reasonable strategy for Mr. Jurek to let this play out. And honestly, I think from his perspective, he probably wasn't risking that much. If the witness presented himself, he would put him on. But I think that we made the point in our brief that Mr. Barnes, who also knew Mr. Shire, had failed to identify him as the shooter. That could be enough to put reasonable doubt in the minds of one or two jurors. If you bring in another witness who's as impeachable as Mr. Khabibi was to say the same type of thing, and if that witness is destroyed, and he likely would have been, you undermine, you make it look like, if you're a defense lawyer, you make it look like you're manufacturing this defense for the jury. So there are a lot of reasonable tactical decisions that Mr. Jurek could have made, and were to presume that he was reasonable and acting competently, and Mr. Shire hasn't overcome that burden. Let me just point out a couple more things about the timing of the other motion. First of all, counsel didn't request a continuance contemporaneous with it, so you have to look at it through Judge Downing's eyes, which was, let's start the material witness warrant process right now, minutes before we're supposed to be starting closing argument. And Judge Downing, I think, was correctly informed by the history of the case. Nobody had seen this guy for 9 months. He'd been absent for the 7 months preceding the first trial and just kind of materialized on December 17th. In other words, Judge Downing had no confidence that things were going to suddenly change and that this witness was on his own going to appear, or that through the efforts of the state we were going to be able to bring him in. Secondly, the timing is even more narrow than I think counsel alluded to. They came on the record on September 16th at, I think it was 9:21 a.m., and that was the point where, and then I think it was at 9:30, well, around 9:30 in the morning when defense counsel said, I had a conversation with him at 7:45 this morning. He said he was going to be here at 9 a.m. The short witness was put on. The state rested at 9:39. The jury was instructed at 10:02, and the jury began deliberations at 2:21 p.m. So unless you have a continuance, there's no way that a warrant could have been signed, placed online, delivered to some law enforcement officer, and that law enforcement officer gone out into the field and brought this person into court. And that's assuming that the law enforcement officer could have found the person immediately. And then there would have been an additional delay. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to imagine that this could have dragged on indefinitely. And that's assuming we could have immediately found him, and there's no indication of that.
I wanted to, before we run out of time, just quickly mm-hmm. ask about the constitutional claims that are being made. Mm-hmm. And in the State versus Downing case from the Washington Supreme Court, they address the constitutional rights that are being asserted here and state that denial of a request for material witness warrants violates the right to compulsory process if it prevents the defendant from presenting a witness material to his defense. But then they go on to say whether that denial, and this is interrelated with a continuance, but whether that denial rises to the level of constitutional violation requires a case-by-case inquiry to determine that. So why don't these facts rise to a level of a constitutional violation, which is what's being argued by Mr. Shire in his brief?
Well, because the right to compulsory process
and it's a right to present a defense.
And the right to present a defense. Neither one is absolute. And so, the judge has wide discretion, and you have to show an abuse of discretion to show that this right was violated. What the cases talk about is that there's no mechanistic test and that basic fairness is the key, and that you're entitled to a new trial only if you can show that the material witness warrant would have shown up and that it would have likely changed the result. That's the test. And so...
Well, we would just be guessing on likely change the result.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think that's why I spent some time talking about how impeachable and how risky this witness really was for the defense. But I think that the clearer argument in these circumstances is that when you ask for your compulsory process rights to be vindicated minutes before closing argument is about to begin,
it's not timely.
There's just no time to do it. So you're right, you have that right, but it's not absolute. You have to exercise it prudently and responsibly. And that's why I think counsel so quickly defaults to the ineffective assistance of counsel argument, because really it's not an abuse of discretion under these circumstances to deny the motion.
So then that takes us right back to whether there was a strategic reason to delay
Correct. The
request.
To whether or not he has shown that there was no strategic reason to deny the request.
And we've already heard that the state announced, I guess, September 11th, that they were not going to call him, and so...
I don't remember that myself, Your Honor. What I can say is that we didn't know where he was. We had attempted to serve him with subpoena, and I don't think... So I think that we had basically given up on it. Remember, too, that we were in the awkward position of then having to put on a witness whose testimony we thought was mostly a lie.
Right.
And we would be impeaching large portions of that testimony. And so, obviously, the person with the keenest interest in getting this witness in, if anybody, would have been Shire or Ibrahim.
Well, the record does seem to indicate that the attorneys for Shire and or Ibrahim did have contact with Mr. Khabib.
Yes, and it was interesting to note that Ms. St. Clair piped in, I think, on September 16th, saying, oh, yeah, I've had contact with
right.
him. I talked to him. He's going to be here at noon or something like that.
Right.
She said, I talked to him at noon.
Right.
Nobody had heard that before either. So, again, we have some back dealings that we're not even a party to. They needed to do better if they really wanted the witness, but I think they had mixed motives.
All right, thank you.
You.